Thank you for tuning in to Not Suitable for Anyone. As a reminder, if you'd like to financially support the show, don't! Just help other people find us by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, or just telling a friend. If you do want to put your hard-earned dollars to work to support our mission, here's what you can do. Buy or rent movies. Redbox, iTunes, Vudu, it doesn't matter. Hell, even an old-fashioned Blu-ray. Leave a review on Letterboxd or Amazon and tell them that you heard about it right here on
Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, thanks for coming back and checking it out. It is Not Suitable for Anyone, episode number 45. We're closing in on a year. Guys, closing in on an entire year since we started doing this later this summer. That's coming up. Will I plan something special? Probably not. Will I try and pull something off at the last minute? We'll see. I'm excited about today's show. It's coming to you a little bit late. Not really been sticking to a great schedule lately, and that's okay. It's summertime. It's weird. Schedules are thrown off. So I'm just going to put stuff out there and put it up as I get it ready. And, you know, that's all I can do. So I've got a really exciting interview today with Adam Stovall. He just dropped his first feature film called A Ghost Waits. You can watch it over on AeroPlayer or you can rent it on VOD. There's also a really, really awesome Arrow Blu-ray that is out that you can buy. Arrow just had a sale, so I don't know if it's still going on, but if it is, check it out. Even if it's not, try and check out the film one way or another. A Ghost Waits. It's awesome. You'll love it. I really dig this movie. It's really cool. It's a very small, contained story, but it's got a lot of heart. It's really meaningful. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful story. That interview is coming up after the break. I'm really excited about it. But first, let's get into our short for today. Not a lot of bells and whistles on this one, but it's a short that was made in 24 hours. Looks like could be from one of those filmmaking competitions. It's a 24-hour short that was made on zero budget. So obviously, I'm interested already. It's called Saudade. I think is how you pronounce it. It's Saudade, and it's available on YouTube. I will put a link to the YouTube page in the show notes. But the YouTube channel is called Megatron Productions. That's with an H, so it's M-E-G-H-A-Tron, T-R-O-N. So that's Megatron Productions, named after its creator, founder, and the director of this short film, Megan McCullen. Megan is a new up-and-coming filmmaker who has put out a good deal of content on her YouTube page, and this is one of the more recent ones. And yeah, I found it interesting, especially since it is a slasher. It's a short film. Again, it's called Saudade. Saudade, if you want to look that up. Again, like I said, link will be in the show description, so definitely check that out. But the story's pretty simple. These three people show up at this abandoned house to investigate the disappearance of someone. And it starts out with him kind of telling the story, and then they decide to split up and investigate this house, and that's when, the killer kind of attacks. It's really simple, which, if you're making a film in 24 hours, you got to keep things simple. But they did go for some effects. There's blood, there's throat slashes, there's blood splatters. It's all practical. And it is not bad. They actually did a little bit of scoring to it, again, on a very tight schedule, which is impressive. They incorporated Foley effects. It's really well put together. Some things about it obviously work better than others, but again, it's just impressive the attention and the time and the detail that went into it, given the limitations that they were working with. So go ahead and check out that short on YouTube. And while you're there, Megan is currently crowdfunding a feature based on this same story. So you can find her crowdfunding page over at Seed and Spark.
Hey guys, my name is Megan, and I'm a 21-year-old filmmaker. And I don't know about you, but I really love horror movies.
Right off the bat, I love the pitch. I love the energy that she has for the genre. And she comes out swinging.
Well, I decided it's about time I make one of my own horror movies. It's called Sodage, and it follows a ragtag TV group in the 90s as they stumble upon a real-life serial killer while filming a documentary about the disappearance of Wesley Henson. We feel it's about time we bring back the classic movie monster era, and with your help, you can make it happen.
So that's the pitch, and they're not looking for a lot. They're looking for about $13,000 is sort of their base goal, and they need, it's Seed and Sparks, they need, I think 80% of that to get the green light and get any funds at all. So they have a plan to make this for, just a little more than $10,000, but you can see on their Seed and Spark page, where the additional money is going to go. So check out Sodage, the short film on YouTube, to see what they can do with 24 hours and no money. And then imagine what they can do with some money and obviously more time to really put things together. So I'm looking forward to this one. I really hope that they get this made, and we'll see what happens. So that was kind of a little bit of a double dip, but I do have another crowdfunding project that I wanted to talk about this week. Another thing that I just jumped on and supported. And I'm really excited about this one as well. This is got a really unique look to it. It's called Death and Life. It's also up on Seed and Spark. You got about 2 weeks left on this one, really more like 13 days at this point. So here's a little bit of their pitch.
Seems we've started a movie about the trials and tribulations of life and death. And we are far too deep to stop now. Say about 6 feet under.
The story takes place in purgatory, filled with the dead, as the main character is Death himself. But this is not Death. It's a corpse, like you and I. But he controls the dead, guiding them through purgatory, arriving at a coffin as he buries them, sustaining his own immortality with their bodies. It's a story that on the surface is a fantasy, but upon wading into its waters, you see it as horror and romantic comedy intertwined tightly within it. Much like life, it cathartically taps into all of our emotions, but ultimately is centered around the fear of our own mortality. With death no longer behind us, but right in front of our very eyes, we will have to answer the question, did we live?
So that's the story pitch. It's got this whole fantasy horror aspect to it. But like I said, it's got a very unique look to it, and that's because of the style of photography that they're using, which I quite frankly have never seen in a feature horror film before.
What'll be really unique with this movie is the technology we'll be implementing. Infrared photography.
I can't think of a movie that was shot entirely in infrared. I've seen infrared still photos before, and that's always got an interesting look to it and always gives you a new perspective, but watching a whole film like that should be pretty interesting. There's a lot of samples in their crowd pitch video, so check out the crowdfunding page. I'm going to put it in the show notes as well. Like I said, it's called Death and Life, and that one also is over at Seed and Spark. So yeah, really interesting, two really unique projects that have different, very different, maybe merits from one another. But again, just underscores why I like doing this so much. And it always just gives me something new to look forward to. So definitely check out the short, Sodage, check out the crowdfunding pitch, check out the crowdfunding pitch for Death and Life, a very short period of time to act on either of those. So take a look and let me know what you think, and throw them a few bucks if you're as excited about it as I am. Now, coming up next, after the break, again, I'm going to be joined by Adam Stovall. He is the writer, or one of the co-writer and director of A Ghost Waits, which is a fantastic little ghost story. I highly, highly recommend checking it out. It's really unique. It's really, really depressing in some ways. It's really uplifting in other ways. It's just a really cool story that was brought together through just sheer will and ambition and perseverance from Adam and his whole team. Had a successful festival run. It's been picked up by Arrow. Really, really great things for him, and I really hope he continues to have more success down the road with future projects, because you can tell from watching this that he's a really talented filmmaker, really super nice guy. So stick around for that interview coming up right now.
Whatever the energy is, I go with that.
All right, awesome. I've watched the movie 4 times now, and
I'm sorry.
It's been great, and it's taken a lot for me to even begin to be able to, you know, sort of express how I feel about it. Other than, you know, when I first saw it, obviously it was very moving. But it was really difficult for me to exactly, you know, sort of pinpoint why that is. But after several, you know, rewatches and watching some of the commentaries and listening to you talk about it, and listening to other people, you know, more eloquent than myself, it's all starting to sort of make sense to me as to like exactly why I find this so moving. We'll get into that.
I'm excited to, yeah.
So, Adam Stovall, everyone, writer and director of A Ghost Waits. How are you doing, Adam?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great. You're doing well. You've got your Blu-ray out on from Arrow.
Yep.
And you know, successful festival run. You know, what's it been like watching this film that you spent years putting together, sort of, you know, get out there and get in front of the people?
Very surprising. you know, we worked on this for, oh gosh, 5 years. You know, production itself was 20 days over the course of 3 years. You know, and we were very aware of what we made. It's a very small, very personal, very idiosyncratic film. And so McLeod and I, you know, have had many conversations about our expectation was that we would, you know, self-distribute and have to fight for every inch we could get and every eyeball we could get on it. And then, you know, it had its world premiere at Frightfest Glasgow, which went really well. And it was also a really nice bit of timing because Frightfest Glasgow was like the penultimate festival to happen before everything shut down. But it played really well. We had sold out the house. And so they saw that it worked on a crowd. And then Frightfest brought us back for their main event in August. And once again, great response. We won a few awards. And I think that was when Arrow was like, okay, this has some legs. So suddenly we went from, and I'll tell you, the first distributor that reached out to us was literally a criminal enterprise. it was crazy. Like, just like a little bit of Googling. And I was like, oh no, we can't do this. but, you know, yeah, we really had like no expectations. And so, and you know, Arrow is obviously a huge company based in the UK. So their footprint over there is huge. They're not as well known in the States, although, you know, they definitely have their cult. But yeah, they acquired us and told us that they wanted us to be the key title of their February launch. And I mean, the support from them has just been amazing, and getting to make, I'm a big, as you can tell over my shoulder, I'm a big physical media guy. So getting to make a Blu-ray, I actually like made the menu that comes up when you first put it in, and I edited together all the interviews and coordinated the bonus features, and just, my thumbprints are all over that thing. I am so proud. So yeah, it's just been amazing and wow. very surprising.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah, I guess they're not as well known. And even like, you know, for myself, I always more associated them with, you know, doing like releases and like restorations of older movies and things like that. And that's really how I came to know Arrow. But I was really delighted to see, especially like the last several months, that they were clearly making a big investment in sort of new cult films. And that was, you know, that was sort of one of the inspirations for this podcast in general. Why I created it is I love these small cult movies that are, you know, contemporary. Maybe only a few people are seeing them now, but 20 years from now, everyone's going to say, hey, you guys all slept on this. And, you know, and I want to be the one to say, well, you know what? I was talking about that movie 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, especially now, like we have an almost instant nostalgia, you know, with social media and just basically in essentially the internet culture. You know, whereas I have very little nostalgia for my youth. So I am kind of always looking to like move forward. And that was one of the interesting things is like watching people, reading people's take on the film, and a lot of them keyed into the 90s-ness, which makes a lot of sense because I grew, you know, 90s were kind of a, you know, formative decade for me, and I love the cinema of the 90s. But yeah, like Arrow has an eye turned to like, what is like, who's making stuff now that nobody else is, you know? Because there's a lot of people out there trying to make, you know, superhero movies on a budget or whatever. Arrow really is like, you know, they're featuring a lot of Brian Lanano's work right now, and I think his short films are fascinating because no one else is making short films like him.
Yeah, I've seen a few, and I definitely agree. And yeah, you talk about that sort of 90s aesthetic. I made a comment. I was still like maybe about halfway through my first watch, and I was trying to explain, you know, to somebody what I was seeing. And this was before I really like locked in on what the themes of the film were. And I was just still in that stage of trying to figure out, you know, what is this? Where is this going? And I said that it was as if you gave Kevin Smith a small budget and said, make your own version of Beetlejuice. And I don't mean that to suggest that it's derivative, not at all, but it does have a lot of those hallmarks of, you know, it's like watching Clerks. It's in black and white. It's very talky, but then it's set in this weird universe, you know, like Beetlejuice, where being a ghost is an organization and it's you know, it's just work, and the more I started to think about it, that's kind of a depressing view that you spend your life, you know, working at a job you don't necessarily like, and then when you die, you just become a spectral agent, and you know, and now you do that for your job, presumably for all eternity.
There's a Modest Mouse lyric that I love. You wasted life, why wouldn't you waste death? I feel like, you know, any ghost story that gets told is implicitly applying kind of human rules to the ghosts, you know, because it's all that we can kind of understand. Otherwise, I think you get into like cosmic horror and the whole idea of going crazy at the mere, you know, trying to understand something. But, you know, ghosts, we tend to imbue ghosts with our own things. They're unfinished business. So regret or love or whatever it is. And in fact, when I started working on the script initially, I was playing with the idea of unfinished business, which was the original ending. And then pretty quickly realized, oh, that doesn't work. I told a friend how I was thinking of ending the movie. We were both just like, no, people will be upset. And like, you could probably make it work, but it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And, you know, when you're making a movie for less than the cost of a base level Mercedes, there's really no guarantee you'll get to make another one. So I didn't, you know, it's like the only time you won't have to compromise, outside of all the compromises you're making for budgetary reasons and everything. But like, story wise, There's no way anyone gets to do this ending if you have like a second comma in the budget. Like, come on. Yeah. Or even another zero on the budget, not even adding a comma. But it was fun to just get really specific, you know. And I don't mind that Beetlejuice and Kevin Smith get brought up a lot, because A, Beetlejuice is one of my favorite movies, and it just plays in my head with all the others. And Kevin Smith was a huge influence. You know, when I was young, I did what everybody else did. I had my phases of wanting to write like Tarantino and Kevin Smith and Paul Thomas Anderson and Aaron Sorkin and, you know, all of them. And eventually you just find out that you can't really write like anybody else. Or at least I found that I couldn't really write like anybody else. And so I wrote a script. This is probably about 12 years ago. Maybe a little less, but about 10 years ago, I wrote a script to like stave off a nervous breakdown. And I was just going through a ton of stuff in my personal life and synthesized it into a screenplay. And when I was done, it felt like I'd finally written something that no one else could write, you know? And that just became like the North Star to chase from there on out.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think that's a common thing. And we do this growing up, you know, all throughout our lives, I think, just in like the way that we dress and the way that we, you know, comb our hair or whatever, is we, you know, sort of copy styles, and it would make sense that it would apply to writing as well, where I'm going to write like this person, I'm going to write like that person. And that's just part of your own journey to, you know, find your own voice.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what it is yet. So I'm going to try on these other voices and see, you know, and eventually you sort of, okay, I'm going to pick a little from here, a little from there, and before you know it, it's a whole new thing.
Yeah. And also, like, I think a big part of it, at least for me, I won't speak for anyone else, there is no monolithic writer, but a big part of it for me was what I didn't want to be. Finally having something to react against. I've told the story a couple times, but I was at a film festival and saw a contemporary romantic comedy. This was a few years back, where the main characters pretty much like bond through pop culture, and pop culture is a lot of the language that they use to talk to each other. And it's really well done. It's a good movie. But a couple days later, I watched Marty, which is the 1952 film, I think, that Paddy Chayefsky wrote. Ernest Borgnine plays Marty. He won an Oscar for it. And it's about these two people. Marty is a middle-aged, overweight man who works in a butcher shop and lives with his mom. And he goes out to a dance hall one night with his friends, and he meets a woman who's also middle-aged and like maybe a little frumpy and plain. And they start talking, and there is no pop culture. There's no like, do you like Lawrence Welk? I like Lawrence Welk. It is just like two souls talking to each other about like insecurity and worry and everything. And like watching it, I just thought like, this is timeless. You know, you could do the script now. And I wanted to go on that track. You know, I didn't want to use the kind of hotkey, you know, pop culture references and everything. Like, to me, that stuff has a place in interpersonal relationships, obviously. But if it's so much, writing is hard. And if I'm going to sit down and write, I want to do something that like feels worthwhile and has a shot at timelessness. I think, I don't know. We're all going to die someday. Nothing's timeless. Sorry. Am I doing my Werner Herzog impression now?
Where to go from there? But, Well, and that really kind of ties into a lot of the themes. It's I have a lot of mixed feelings about the film, because it's very uplifting in some ways, and I find Jack in particular for myself very very relatable, and we'll get to that. But there's also a lot of things in here that, you know, the more you think about, you know, they're really depressing.
Yeah.
and kind of bleak.
Fair.
And so, you know, I guess it's just how you come out at the end of the other side of the movie, I guess maybe sort of depends on what, you know, what you choose to focus on. And I think maybe, you know, you can decide to a certain extent, I guess maybe you can decide, you know, how you want to react to this. I mean, we're dancing around it a little bit, but really is the sort of aspect of, you know, with Muriel, when you get into, you know, when he starts really questioning her about why she's doing what she's doing, and, you know, she doesn't really know how long she's been doing it. She doesn't really know what its purpose is. She's just sort of been told that it's her purpose, and sort of the relationship between Muriel and her boss and Jack and his boss. You know, there's a lot to chew on there in terms of, you know, careers and work and sort of, you know, what we choose to do. I have this T-shirt I wear all the time, and I try to talk to my kids about this to the extent they'll listen. They're teenagers now, so I'm kind of basically out of time for them listening to me. But it's this guy is talking to his old man. He's talking to this young child, and he asks her, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And she replies, "An honest, brave, compassionate human being." And he says, "No, I mean, how do you want to sell your labor?"
I think I need that shirt.
Yeah, I'll send you the link. It's great, and I wear it every Labor Day.
Yeah,
but yeah, and I try to make sure that they understand that, you know, that's who you are is not the same question as, you know, what do? How do you pay the mortgage? You know, yeah. These are different questions, but we have a culture that tends to conflate them.
Yeah. Yeah, when I wrote this, things were bad. Things were really bad. I'd been completely unemployable for a while, like just could not get hired anywhere. I had started working in audiobooks at this point. I was starting to do that, but like I had been going, I applied to Subway and couldn't get hired. I mean, just no one. And like, so it had really become kind of a fixation of mine, what you do versus how you, you know, what you do for a living versus who you are. And becoming acutely aware of how American, you know, it is to prioritize how you make your living, you know, that your worth is dictated by your bank account. That idea. And fortunately over the last 5 years, I've actually like, I'm in a much better place now because I've kind of divorced myself from that notion. You know, just because my bank account is low doesn't mean that my self-esteem should be, which I can say now that I finally have some self-esteem. I do not have anything in my bank account still, but, yeah, like also, I mean, when you feel kind of left behind by society, you spend a lot of time looking around, you know, because you don't have that momentum, you know, you're not caught up in the wake of anything. And just so many people kind of, and I think last year, you know, 2020 really put like a highlighter on this, like how many people were living thoughtlessly and just letting momentum carry them through their days. You know, they establish a routine and then they just keep doing it and they don't analyze why they're doing it and what it says about them. And then 2020 happened and all of our routines were taken away and some of us were more prepared for that than others. but yeah, I think why do you do what you do is a question that everybody should ask. And I think repeatedly asked. I think that your answer at 15 is different from your answer at 20, which is different from your answer at 25. Like, you know, just because you're doing something doesn't mean it's what you should be doing. And I like self-reflection. I think more people should do it. But like also understand that you could be wrong. There's a lot of that. I feel like a lot of people kind of default to like, well, I'm right. And it's like, no, maybe not. Making a movie is actually a great example. I wrote the script. You know, I had the idea. I birthed these characters. But then you bring in your collaborators And what you don't want to do, especially when you're not really paying anybody anything, you know, nobody got a real check on this. What you don't want to do is say, now don't have any ideas. You know, just execute what I tell you to execute. Like, I want to be the least qualified person on my set. Like, I want, you know, everybody to know their craft so I can tell them what I'm thinking and then they can make it look or sound or play better than I could. You know, it's kind of like you read these essays and reviews and it's like, man, this makes me sound so much smarter than I am. You know, and a lot of it is just leaving yourself open to there being a better idea from someone else and say, and recognizing that's the better idea. Let's go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a saying that, you know, if you find that you are constantly the smartest person in the room, then you need to move to a smarter room.
That's good.
You can't grow, I think, as a person, or it's very difficult if you're not able to learn from other people.
Yeah.
And I've had to put that into practice before, you know, at places that I've worked where I'm like, I can't progress from here because I'm not really learning anything anymore. I'm giving back and I'm teaching other people and kind of pulling them along, but I need to, you know, I need personal growth for myself. I need to find somewhere where I can continue to progress. And it's hard making those decisions, but
I'm kind of going through a strain of that right now. Before all of this, I had written a thing, I'd written a pilot, and then late 2019 was like, well, nobody's really looking at me to make a pilot, but I might be able to make another low budget indie. So I took my favorite subplot out of the pilot and put it into its own fade in document. It was like, oh, I'll figure that out later. And then we had our world premiere. Some companies reached out. One of them asked what else I was working on. I sent them this thing. Long story short, now I'm developing that into a feature script. And doing that, making A Ghost Waits affected how I write so much because I wrote it, I directed it, I produced it, I shot the pickups, I edited the whole thing. I taught myself to edit in order to edit it. Like all this stuff. And especially the editing has such an impact because, you know, it's like, as the editor, I'm just sitting here bitching about the writer all the time. Like, oh my God, dude, you don't need any of this. Like, why? So you're just cutting it down. Well, now as I'm writing, I have that editor brain that's just like, you know, you're going to cut this. This doesn't do anything. And it's not that clever, you know, but in the writer brain is like, shut up. I need to do this in order to get to the good stuff. But I've also never had as many eyes on me while I'm writing as I do right now, which is great. It's a great problem to have because it means we're probably going to make another movie. But I feel like I'm relearning how to write on a timer. So it's just like constant panic attacks. Like, oh God, I'm fucking up completely. Yeah, it is. You're right. Like you have to push yourself to grow constantly. I think you also have to know when to take your foot off the gas sometimes and allow yourself a moment to breathe. Because the people that like fetishize growth are equally annoying, you know, where it's just like rise and grind and that kind of thing. Where you're like, no, you're allowed to just like be a person for a second. You don't have to be, you know, monetizing everything and turning it all into content or whatever. Like, just take a breath. Go sit on a bench. It's nice out. I mean, it's hot as hell right now in New York, but it's nice out. Go outside.
Yeah. Oh, boy. And that's true. You have to kind of give yourself permission to do that. I don't know what it is about our culture in America, but it seems like whatever it is, we do it 110%, right? Whether it's working or partying or, you know, food, whatever it might be. You know, we seem like we want to do it all, you know, to the extreme, and other cultures look at us and go, what are you guys doing? You guys are crazy.
Right. No, we're a much more competitive culture, which I think is probably due to making capitalism our religion, you know, where, you know, the only way to advance is to outwork the person next to you, which is not true. But it's, yeah, that's the doctrine of our nation. And I think we're moving in a direction where we're starting to understand that and like kind of break down the cult of work. I'm hopeful that we are. But yeah, no, I think you're exactly right.
It's strange. You're right that it's this lie that we tell everyone that if you work harder, you know, you'll earn more, you'll advance. And really there are a large number of different things that all might factor into, you know, why one person, you know, advances through an organization and another person doesn't. You know, and it's.
I mean, just look at the Frank Grimes episode of The Simpsons.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example. absolutely. But we, yeah, and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward, because you just need to keep people busy and occupied, and, you know, short-term sort of goal-focused, and they won't have time to sit around and think about these more existential questions. They won't have time to say, hey, why am I doing this? Because yeah. if they stop doing whatever it is they're doing, then they're going to fall behind.
Yeah. It's weird that, like, when we're young, we're told the story of the tortoise and the hare, and then, like, once you're, like, 10, it's just like, now forget that. Forget the moral of that story. Yeah, you'd think we'd be better at having two thoughts in our head at one time, but
nah. Yeah,
somehow.
So that's you know, those are the themes that I would call some of the more, you know, some of the more depressing or bleak themes of the movie. But the part that I prefer to focus on is, you know, I personally find this a very romantic story. And I am definitely like in the category of people that you would call like the hopeless romantic. You know, I believe in things like love at first sight and, you know, and true love and things like that. And the, you know, I met my wife when we were 17 years old.
Aww.
And we are still married today. And we're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. And I understand
you do not look nearly that old. Earlier you mentioned having teenagers. I was like, that's impossible. Okay, no. It's not impossible.
Yeah, no, it's true. No, we're probably about the same age. I turned 42 this year.
I turned 42 last year.
So,
yeah.
So, and I get that kind of, you know, true love type of you know, and the sort of like societal idea of romance can be toxic to people, and it can lead to dangerous and toxic things. And I get that. And so I don't, you know, I don't want to suggest, I would never want to suggest that, you know, that you can't be a complete person if you don't have those things. You know, if you go through life, you know, from one relationship to another, to, you know, maybe a time and now the relationship, that doesn't make you less of a person or less complete, in the same way that, you know, having a large bank account or not, it affects in any way, you know, what, how complete of a person you are. But I do believe that those things, you know, do exist for some people. I believe they exist for me. And so I found just a lot to relate to with Jack and Muriel and their relationship and their ultimate resolution in this film.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely a romantic. It's odd. You know, the two main inspirations for this movie were a video game and a web comic. The video game is PT. It's a first-person haunted house puzzle game that Guillermo del Toro and Hideo Kojima designed. And I had, you know, a couple of my friends. I'm not a big video game player, but a couple of my friends are. And they had me come over to play it. And I just had them cracking up laughing with my reactions, because, you know, you're in a haunted house. And so spooky lighting and you know, suddenly like a baby starts crying from nowhere. And I was just like, nope, don't need to investigate that. I'm fine. and then they were laughing so hard that it made me think, like, you know, I've never seen a haunted house with a character like me at the center of it. And around this time, I saw a comic called Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, where a man asks a woman, what's the most American movie? And she says, oh, that's easy, Ghostbusters. Because you have demonstrable proof of an afterlife, but the whole thing is about growing a small business and navigating government bureaucracy. And I thought, well, that's really funny, but also like, yeah, a ghost, like, ghosts do mean there's an afterlife. I would have so many questions. And so it kind of started there, the idea of if I was in a haunted house and I met a ghost, what would I do? And that's where the, you know, does it hurt to be dead? Like, you know, does this mean there's a God? Have you met him or her? All that stuff. And I think once I started doing that, like, I had the idea of Muriel. Sorry, I'm working on a couple of scripts right now, so I have to keep like which character name? Okay. Because some of them are kind of close to each other. But like the idea of Muriel being this, being a ghost and wanting to explore a new idea of that. So the idea of being a ghost is her job. And, you know, people fall in love at work. And especially if like somebody comes in and they're curious about you, that feels really nice. Somebody asking you, you know, taking an interest in what you do and how you do it and why you do it feels really good. And both of them, I really like writing quote unquote broken people. Because that's what I have experience in, being broken. So, like, the idea that some, you know, when you feel like you're not really a person and you're not entitled to take up space in the world, you know, obviously I have struggled with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation pretty much my entire life. And I wanted to explore that, partially because this is how I work through things, but also because if I'm dealing with this, somebody else is dealing with it. And I've always been kind of annoyed by how depression is portrayed in film, because they tend to go with very overt, the more dramatic manifestations of it, whether that's bipolar disorder, you know, manic depression, all that stuff. Whereas to me, depression is wallpaper. You know, it's wallpaper that tells you you don't deserve walls. And I'd never seen that. And so this is kind of the equation, you know, I heard a quote one time, art is math plus fire. Like, screenwriting is very mathematical. And this is basically how that happens. This is the equation, is I want to explore mental health and I want to, you know, and my background obsession with class and capitalism and everything will play into all of this because, okay, well, it's a job, you know, this is, a very human understanding of things, or rooted in humanity. And then it just became like these two people became very interesting to me, and sitting them down and letting them talk. You know, especially when you're making a movie for no money, the best special effect you can afford is the actor's face. The best special effect overall really is the actor's face, but, you know, there's one effect in this movie, and it's like the simplest photographic effect in the world. But, you know, it puts the onus on you to cast it, you know, properly. And I mean, I knew what I had with McLeod, because we've been friends for a long time. And I'm very, I helped him build, put his reel together. Like, I had a pretty strong sense of what he can do. Natalie, I hadn't met before. I'd seen her online, and I had this feeling that she was kind of, that she, like, putting her in this role would be like putting Robin Williams in a dramatic role where there's so much energy. She's so brilliant and hilarious and just like emanates this wonderful energy. And it's like, well, if she has to keep all of that inside for a character that demands a lot of stillness, I felt like it would kind of vibrate the way it did with Robin Williams. And, you know, which is, when I said earlier, I finally have self-esteem, like, part of what this 5-year journey has been was like, I started learning to trust my instincts. And once I started doing that, then it became more of like recognizing, oh, I have value to the world. Oh, I am allowed to take up space. You know, I don't need to like be worried about everybody around me on the Metro North when I'm going up to Connecticut for a gig, which is a genuine thing that used to happen, where it's just like, hey, that perfect stranger over there might need something. I better be on guard just in case they do. It's like, yeah, that's not your job. There's literally people here to take care of the passengers. No, no, no. I can't just be sitting here. I'm not worth that. welcome to Mental Health Hour with Adam and Pat. yeah, you know, I love a good romance. I love a good romance, but it has to be earned. I want a happy ending, but I need to earn it. You know, I hate just a saccharine ending. And in the case of this, like a friend of mine said the other day, she was like, "Oh, you kind of do like optimistic existentialism," which I really like. I was like, "Put that on the memorial plaque when I'm gone." But yeah, like with what we built to, I knew that with the gift of context, you know, like once you figure in the context of the story, he basically just moves to Denver for a girl.
Right.
But it's that heightenedness of telling a horror story and working in genre where you can make it opera and it can end the way that it ends. And as long as a couple things happen, you're fine, you know. I cannot tell you how many people have been like, I never thought I would like an ending like this, but I really liked it here. And it's like, yeah, because we, you know, we worked on it and we never lost sight of the characters and of the emotions.
I was really shocked the first time I watched the ending. I guess your brain is still so attuned, or mine is, you know, from watching so many movies and from watching, you know, just for the lack of a better word, like typical, like traditional Hollywood movies. And it was like what you said, where if you add another zero to the budget or add a comma to the budget, this ending doesn't happen because some executive is just going to react just to the idea of it on paper without really understanding the concept or seeing how it's gonna play out. And I just remember my jaw hitting the floor and going, oh, that's where it's going.
There was a really lovely thing that happened after Glasgow. And I mean, immediately, like there in the room, like, people were so warm and so receptive and coming up like thanking me for it and saying that it made them feel seen and heard and that, you know, that stuff, which is the best. Like, it's really the best thing that can happen. I saw in the discussion group a few days later that somebody had said, like, I need to talk about the ending of A Ghost Waits. And somebody, you know, was like, I worry that it's glamorizing romance. I was like, I don't deal with this, but I worry about those who do. And someone else responded, I do deal with this. It is a constant struggle. And like, this does not glamorize or romanticize it. A movie is not going to make me take my own life, but it will make me feel seen and heard, make me feel less alone for a moment. You know, and my whole thing has become that we are so bad at talking about suicide. It is such a societal taboo that anytime someone brings it up, it is immediately hand waved. It's like, not that that should ever happen. And that's a selfish thing. And I always say, like, I don't know. I kind of think making someone else's death about you is more selfish, but whatever. What do I know? I'm a bear. I eat the heads off fish. You know, there's a lot of movies for people who have lost someone. And that's great. And I will never diminish anyone's grief or loss. This isn't for you. This is for those that we lose. There's a lot of I know I'm not the only person struggling with this. And I say this is the movie that I wish existed when I was 15. You know, I feel like I'd be a healthier person if I'd had this sort of cinematic hug in my life. So yeah, you know, and also, yeah, when you're working with a little bit of money, with a very small amount of money, like, you don't have to worry about the four quadrants. You don't have to worry about one quadrant. Like, I remember I've joked with McLeod so many times, we made a movie for 9 people, you know, but like, we're going to find all of them, you know, like, we're going to make sure this gets out so that all 9 of those people know that we love them and we are here for them.
Yeah. What's his name? Was it Oscar from the Arrested Development? There are dozens of us. Dozens. But that's great, and I can appreciate that, and yeah, I think you're right. I think it probably hits differently based on whether you are a person who struggles with, you know, suicidal ideation versus somebody who has had a loved one commit suicide, because I think that themselves, you know, like doesn't understand this. I mean, my mother's that way. I'll never forget, because it left a huge impact on me, even though it had nothing to do with me. It was my brother had a friend in high school. He took his own life at 17 or 18 years old. I forget the exact age. And he was my brother's close friend. And so, you know, my mother talked to me about it, even though I didn't know this person at all. The only thing I got, my only exposure to it was like the conversation with my mom. And she didn't say these words exactly, but it was clear from what she said that she didn't get it. She didn't understand, you know, she couldn't comprehend like what would go through a person's mind that would take their own life. And you know, and all she could see was, you know, how it affected those around her, you know, her firstborn son, her you know, the young boy's mother, you know, those kinds of things were all she could see, and not, you know, not what was happening in the mind of this troubled teenager. And it has stuck with me all these years, because my brother was 6 years older than me, so I was 11 or 12 when this happened, and I still remember this. I mean, there's not a week or a month that goes by that I don't think about that. And especially now, as my kids are getting into their teens, and I understanding. And I'm remembering what it was like, what it's like being a teenager, and, you know, everything feels like life or death in high school.
Yeah.
And you can't control that. It just does. And, you know, and I just hope that, you know, that I never have to deal with something like that. But more importantly, that, you know, that with my kids, that I have an open line of dialogue where they know, you know, that they can come to me, and that I'm involved enough in their lives that I can recognize, you know, warning signs and things and say, okay, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And just be able to communicate about it. I had a friend take his own life very young. And it was, I mean, very young. And so it kind of was part of that like foundational table setting that happens when you're a kid and you're starting to learn. And my first memory is, in fact, my sister dying. The reason my company is named Rebecca Films is because her name was Rebecca. And it's very hard to make a movie, and it's very tempting to phone it in or half-ass things at a certain point. And so I put her name on my company to make sure that I never half-ass anything or phone anything in, to kind of keep me honest. And so I can't remember a time when I was not aware of mortality. But having lost friends to suicide, and having, you know, kind of come right up to the edge a few times myself, I'm very aware of what is needed. You know, have you seen the new Bo Burnham special Inside that's on Netflix right now?
Oh, not yet. I've been meaning to. Yeah.
Okay. He touches on this a bit, and I won't tell you what that is because I don't want to ruin it for you. But yeah, like if you start paying attention to how people talk about things, you know, they really do show their ass. Because it is a struggle. And it is a very hard decision sometimes to keep going. It's not selfish to give up, you know? If somebody's trying to build, you know, if you're trying to put a crib together and it just keeps falling apart and you put it, you try again and it keeps falling apart and this part won't go into that part. And why doesn't there's no hole for the screw where it says there should be a hole. And, you know, it's just, it never, and you spend days and weeks and months trying to put this crib together and it never does. Like, if you just keep doing that, people will tell you, you know, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing and expect different results. Well, it's a metaphor, but like, that's what this is. You know, you're going through every day feeling like you can't put it together. And at some point you stop trying. And people like your mom and this person that went on Facebook, like, that can't understand it, can't understand like how somebody could be driven to that or could arrive at that decision in their lives. I would say, like, that's fine. You don't have to understand it, but like, it's still real, you know?
Right.
Like, you just say yes, you know, you still listen. You can't tell someone that they're wrong. You know, because you don't understand it. This is an opportunity. And even if you don't want to take the opportunity to learn more about it, the very least you could do is just say, I'm sorry. You know, maybe hug them if they want to hug. If they don't. But yeah, just listen. It's the best thing you can do.
Yeah, I agree. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, and people are entitled to their feelings and their reactions,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that's not a replacement for someone else's experience.
Right. Yeah, they coexist. They don't prioritize.
Yeah. Like you can feel anger at a situation, and that's a human reaction. You can't, you know.
Yeah. If I'm not hungry, I'm not going to legislate that food shouldn't exist just because I'm not hungry. Or if I'm not hungry and you are, like, how dumb would it be if I was just like, no, you're not. I don't understand that. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Empathy, people. Empathy. Try it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Something a little less heavy. Tom Waits.
Less heavy, huh? Okay. Oh, Tom.
Yeah. Clearly a big influence on...
Huge. Yeah, so normally, like, when I've written stuff in the past, I eventually figure out, like, it takes me, like, 3 years to write something. And I generally title it and name the characters late in the process. I write a lot of A-B scenes. Because I kind of find I tend to discover the character and how they interact and how they behave. But with this, I couldn't do that because we had a budget before I had a script. So we hit the ground running on this, and because I couldn't wait, I just basically went home, and because we had to make these documents for casting and whatnot, and title the film because of other documents. So I went home and opened up my Tom Waits discography and named every character after a Tom Waits song and called the movie A Ghost Waits after Tom Waits. I'm still stunned I got to, like nobody ever made me change that. Like, it's kind of a nonsense title, but people like it. So I'm like, all right, cool. Like, I'm down for that. So I hope he hears this someday. I'd really like him to know how much his work has meant.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And yeah, I like the title. It's, you know, titles are hard.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe for some people they come easy, but The only titles that I've ever found easy were the titles that you write, that you come up with, and then you write a screenplay around. But
oh, that's like, interesting.
Yeah, I when I was in high school, I wrote a screenplay called Disco Bear.
What was it about?
Now the pitch would be Ted meets Saturday Night Fever.
Nice.
And I immediately dated it by having the opening scene having him do a dance number with, what's her name? The Joey Buttafuoco,
Amy Fisher?
Amy Fisher, yeah.
That's delightful. Oh, people are going to hear this and demand you that the script gets made.
I did actually dig it out of an old file folder. I was going through like papers and like throwing things out, and I found it, and it's all like handwritten, and there's even like little like things written on scraps of paper that are taped over other things, and I said, you know what, to hell with it, and I scanned the whole thing in, and I submitted it, and I got a U.S. copyright registration on it. I'm like, one of these days I'm gonna finish this.
Well, clearly one of the episodes of the podcast has to be a script read.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
But yeah, having an idea for a story and then like figuring out like what to call it is so hard for me. It's
I think like I musicality figures in very heavily for me, and so the way something sounds. And I remember going back and forth, is A Ghost Waits or just Ghost Waits better? And like going back and forth between those. I'm like, okay, I think it's got to be A Ghost Waits, but yeah, it's a sticky wicket, because there's a lot of bad titles, you know, but it's also so subjective, like what makes a bad title versus what makes a good title, you know, I don't know, there's no science to it.
Yeah.
God, yeah. I wish there was, it was so much easier.
It's funny. I was thinking about Disney went through that whole research when they kind of had their second renaissance, or maybe it was their third renaissance, and they started doing the adjective titles, and that became a thing for a while. You know, it wasn't Rapunzel; it was Tangled.
Tangled, yeah.
Which I think is better. Is that a better title than Rapunzel? I mean, I think so. I mean, we all know what Rapunzel is, but.
But that's the thing. When that first time he didn't, the first time you just see a nonsense word Rapunzel, and you're like, "What the hell's that?" And you read, and it's like, "Oh, Rapunzel's a girl. Oh, she's got really long hair, and a very strong scalp, apparently." yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, one thing I have kind of figured out is that I never regret leading with my heart. So. When it comes to any of this stuff, when I'm writing a scene, you know, I try to lead with my heart and like focus on what the emotions are, and you know, the trying to be fair to all the characters, you know, which is not to say that you can't have villains, but like I just think too often we give short shrift to the humanity of our characters. But, you know, in naming, you know, in titling and everything, like, I don't know, naming characters is weirdly, like, so much harder than it should be. But it's like, they're just, I mean, they're not even real people. Like, just name him Brian, man. Name her Madison. Like, who gives a shit? But I will spend so long going over. I'm the script that I'm writing right now, the script that I'm prioritizing right now that I'm writing, like I have renamed characters so many times, and you know, it's like, okay, well, this one I'm kind of happy with, and this does this, so I like that. But like one character right now, I'm probably going to rename her again because I'm just not happy with what it is. And it's like, this is so stupid. This is not something you need to be worried about. But I've kind of figured out that I like harmony in a film, and that starts at the script level. You know, when I read the script, I have to like the elements of it. The elements of the script have to work in harmony. And if a name is sticking out to me, then that's telling me that the name isn't right. So it's a very intuitive process, which is frustrating and confounding, and I hate it. Don't make movies, kids. They're dumb. Don't do it.
So speaking of making movies, there was a discussion that I found very interesting, because this is a concept I find fascinating, which is the film by credit that we see in a lot of movies, which A Ghost Waits does not have.
Nope.
And you know, I know you had some really interesting, you know, things to say. It had always struck me, and I don't mean to criticize anyone who has put that credit on their films, but it seems like a very arrogant thing to do.
I thought it was interesting that Corey wanted to discuss that on our commentary together. Yeah, I agree. I mean, listen, Robert Altman is one of my favorite directors of all time, and he did a Robert Altman film. So, you know, I'm not going to say that anybody who does it is wrong, but yeah, it does. It feels a little arrogant, a little, you know, exclusive. And it just didn't feel right to me. You know, my name is on it enough as it is, you know, directing it, writing it, producing it, editing it, shooting some of it, doing craft services, casting, like, you know, all of that. Like, my name's on it enough. I didn't need it to be on another time. But I also didn't really want, you know, when we open it, I wanted McLeod and Natalie front and center. And it was very important to me that they shared a card, you know, they're in those two corners. Like, it was very important because this is them, you know, and when this is done, because especially McLeod has done other stuff, you know, and he's won awards for other stuff. He was in Dr. Sleep. I mean, you know, he works and people know him. Natalie has achieved a level of fame and has fans, and like, so I've also just been to a ton of screenings where people will like clap for their friends. And I don't think I had this like really at like the front of my mind, but the idea of like anyone clapping for my name on this movie at the beginning was just like, that's dumb. Like, no one has any idea what that means right now. So, and like I say on the commentary, I remember Pulp Fiction, you know, when Jules finishes his monologue, you know, that scene ends, they leave, the music starts up, cut to black, written, directed by Quentin Tarantino. And I just remember really being struck by that. Like, oh, that's who did this. Like, okay, fascinating. But yeah, you know, even on the next one, I don't think I'll ever use the authorial credit. And I don't judge anyone who does. I don't like it. And I can't control any other movie, but I can control mine. So it'll never, I'm almost certain it will never be there. If you ever see one that it is on there, like, ask me why, because I may have not been able to control it.
No, I will. Yeah, and I think there's rules once you get into like the guilds and things like that. You know, there's rules about that. I was reading recently, because about Sin City, and that I guess the DGA wouldn't let Frank Miller share directorial credit with Robert Rodriguez because Frank Miller wasn't an established name, and I don't know, they have all these peculiar rules about multiple directors, and and so Rodriguez actually resigned from the guild as a result, which I wasn't necessarily aware that that you could do, but it makes sense. Yeah, it's fascinating. I know they have some very particular rules on how, you know, how credits can appear and things like that. And I get the need to protect your members. I mean, that's why unions exist.
Right.
But sometimes they also like create a lot of arbitrary bureaucracy that may not actually be necessary.
Yeah. Well, if you ever, there's a really good documentary called Casting By that gets into the world of casting directors and what they do. And part of it is, you know, there's been this push for an Oscar for casting, and it's the DGA that's preventing it because directors like to say, I cast the movie, you know, the casting director gives me options, I cast the movie. But like, you know, you watch the documentary and you're like, there's a lot more to casting than like who are the leads. You know, good casting. I remember like David Chase talking about when they started making The Sopranos. He went with the casting directors of Trees Lounge because he thought that the world of Trees Lounge was the most complete, like, of, you know, like of a piece casting that he'd seen, you know? And so it's like, yeah, that's what that is. Like they fill out the world, you know? I worked on a movie where because there was no money, our background casting was odd. And we were constantly like, well, this scene is supposed to do this, but with all the people around them, it now looks totally different. Yeah, it really, and it's why, you know, when I was writing A Ghost Waits and a few other things, I tend to write very contained things so that we're not at the mercy of whoever's available to be background that day. You know, especially with this, like, there are very few. There's like, what, 6 speaking roles total? Yeah. I mean, you know, that you can get smaller. You know, you can make was it All Is Lost, the movie that's just Robert Redford on a boat. But yeah, you know, I knew that I want, you know, it's like, well, we're not gonna have a lot of money, so let's play to our strengths and try to get rid of as many weaknesses as possible. Not be at the mercy of the universe.
No, that makes sense.
Well, I mean, because I know you've listened, like, how'd you like the bonus features? How'd you like the commentaries?
I really enjoyed all the discussions. I'm about 2/3 of the way through the cast and crew, but I've listened to you and McLeod and you and what was her name?
Corey Loeffler.
Corey, yeah.
Yeah.
And the video essay, I thought also was absolutely
Izzy
absolutely beautiful.
Crushed that. She's so amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Where do you go from here? Because this is such a solid home run to me. I mean, I feel like this movie does everything that it sets out to do. It knows, you know, it knows what it is. It feels like you knew exactly what you could do, and you sort of stayed in that box, and you got every square inch out of it that you possibly could.
Thank you so much. That is like, that is the best compliment we could hope for. 'Cause yeah, that's pretty much it. We, you know, we knew what we didn't have, and we had a decent idea of what we had. And we just decided that simplicity was going to guide us. You know, I think a lot of people confuse simplicity with ease, and it's definitely not, it's not easy to do this, but, you know, a lot of people, I think, get insecure about not having a budget. And so they try to put a bunch of bells and whistles on it to obfuscate that reality. The problem is they're buying those bells and whistles at a dollar store, so they still sound cheap. Like, we just went the opposite direction. Like, how can we make this as simple and clean as possible? In terms of what comes next, you know, we're figuring that out. We've been ridiculously lucky with this, you know, the legs that it's had, the response that it's engendered. It's just been amazing. And yeah, now it looks like we're going to get to make another one, possibly 2 more. So there's a script that I've already written that there's some interest in, and we're kind of getting that up on its legs to go out into the world with a producer. And there's the one that I'm writing that has a bunch of companies waiting to see the draft, because I wrote the first draft, but I forgot to put a second act in it. So I'm going back and fixing that now. But it's the best idea I've ever had. And McLeod's really excited for that to go. So, you know, now, like, kind of macro sense, what's next is figuring out how to be a working artist. You know, like I said, it took me 3 years to write things for the longest time, and now I do not have that luxury. So it's kind of like trying to access the space where I can, you know, kind of let the world be itself and let the characters talk, while also having like obligations and responsibilities. You know, I can't just, back when I was living with my dad, you know, around the time of making this movie, like, I could write whenever I wanted. Like, there was no one expecting anything from me. Now, I like, my calendar is ridiculous. McLeod, the other Sunday, we were doing our little work day, and he looked at both of our calendars in Google. He was like, I'm going to have a panic attack if I look at this for any longer. It's kind of ridiculous. But, you know, you can't lose momentum just because a good thing is happening. So I'm learning how to kind of silo things and, you know, work my way into a space where I can be responsible and productive. I'll tell you how that goes. I'll let you know. I mean, you know, right now I don't feel like I'm crushing it, to be honest. But, you know, I don't sleep a lot. But then, like, I'll take a nap and I'll get up and be like, oh, that's what that scene is. Like, I had that yesterday morning. There's a scene that has just been eluding me for months now. And it's a thing where, like, I know the three characters, I know where it starts, I know where it ends, I knew all that stuff. And I started, you know, like I said, I tend to approach this mathematically. So I have my poles, you know, where a character starts here and one character starts here, and they have to end at the opposite poles. And there has to be a power exchange at some point. I mean, it is, I do draw it out like a, you know, the plot structure looks like a wave graph. And it's very odd, but like, and so even knowing all that stuff, I couldn't get them to talk. Like, for whatever reason, like, it just would not talk to each other. And yesterday morning I got up very early and I was reading about Tomarax and Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and between those two things I was like, oh, I think I have it. Which I don't know if you know what Tomarax are. Mm-hmm. But they're part of fusion physics. They're basically a donut-shaped reactor, wherein they have a thermal a coating that controls that guards the heat. But it's basically where we are trying to create stars.
Okay.
So we have to be able to create something that burns at, you know, at least 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. And at this point, we're up to like almost 10 times that, but we can't get it to sustain. You know, I think they got something to burn at like 217 million degrees Fahrenheit for 20 seconds or 25 seconds in China. And that's the closest we've gotten. But reading about that keyed me into something that one of the characters would be doing. And then I was also reading about Portrait of a Lady on Fire and the scene where Alain is painting. Oh, God. Eloise? One woman is painting the other woman and says, you know, and it starts telling her like, oh, this is all the stuff that I've observed about you. This is what you do when you're annoyed, and this is what you do when you're flustered, and this is what you do when, and eventually it turns. And that thing was like, oh, I had my math, but this is how it actually happens. And so between those two things, I was just like, yes, I'm going to get some actual writing done. So it's like, you're trying to, you know, I think it's really normal to want to minimize the blind alleys, but the blind alleys are such a vital part of the process. And so I'm like, I'm trying to make it more efficient. And I'm just realizing how stupid that is. Like, you're never going to make it more efficient. You never know where inspiration is going to come from. So it's really just about like staying as open as possible and as receptive as possible. So that's what's next. What a long and wandering answer. Thanks, no, Adam.
That's great. That's great. A friend of mine is a criminal defense lawyer, and he was explaining once like why he basically just bills like a flat fee for for a particular case. And he explained that the reason is it's really, you know, true that a jury trial is storytelling. It's just a different, mm-hmm. different form and a different audience and maybe different stakes, but you have to tell a story to the jury about who your client is and, you know, why they shouldn't go to jail or what have you. And he said, well, I get my best ideas when I get out of the office, get away from the books. And I'm in my garage, you know, like doing something physical, like working on my motorcycle. And that's when I come up with, oh, okay. If I explain it like this and I show them this and that, then, you know, this is how, They get there and he's like, what am I supposed to do? Like send my client a bill for cleaning out the carburetor? like
that's a great point. Yeah.
So I definitely get that. Like you have to, those moments of inspiration can come at any time. And often, I've read something that suggested that it's almost the way that our brain chemistry works, to process like the physical movements, just even like the act of walking around, it requires your brain to fire in a certain way to make one leg go in front of the other and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that like firing can trigger something. And all of a sudden this idea that you couldn't quite get your arms around suddenly makes sense. And there's no reason why that should work. But if you had just sat staring at your computer screen, it might never have happened. And it's just about trying to get your brain to fire in just the right way.
I'm deeply envious of George Bernard Shaw once said, somebody asked him, do you write when the muse comes or do you have like set hours for writing? And he said, I write when the muse comes. Fortunately, they know to visit between 9 and 5 Monday through Friday, which I'm very envious of that. But yeah, I mean, that's huge, is just understanding understanding when to take your hands off the wheel, understanding when, take a nap, go to the movies, walk around. I live in New York, so walk around, and just there's so much stuff going on, but just let the synapse fire and, let the connections just kind of happen. It's random and you can't dictate randomness. I, as much as I wish I could.
Right.
Yeah,
it's great. So, listen, Adam, I really appreciate it. I think you've been very generous with your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Why don't you tell people, where they can find you, hear about what's coming next, where do you want people to, connect with you online, that sort of thing.
Well, you can find me on Instagram at @notAdamS and Twitter at Adam Stovall. The movie has a Twitter at A Ghost Waits. It has a website, aghostwaits.com. You can send emails through that if you would like to. That's where I'm at. I have a Facebook, but I haven't seen it in a long time. So.
That's great. And the film, the Arrow Blu-ray is out right now. You can buy it anywhere.
Blu-ray is out. You can also rent or buy it online. iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon all have it. I think it's like a $6 or $8 rental right now. If you're a big physical media fan, I worked really hard on the Blu-ray and I hope you like it.
Yeah, the Blu-ray is fantastic. I can vouch for that. It's beautiful packaging, great artwork, and some good bonus features, and a little booklet with a nice essay in that as well, going into more of some of the themes of the films.
Yeah, Craig did a really good job on that. That's another one of those places. If you let smart people talk about stuff, you will sound smarter. That's totally what I was doing. Thanks, guys. Yeah, it's a pretty wonderful thing. And really, I want to thank you. Movies of this size live or die by word of mouth. So people like yourself who see it and dig it, we really appreciate you spreading the word and being very enthusiastic about sharing your love for it. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, yeah, you're very welcome. And that's definitely a big part of, what I want to contribute to this earth before I leave it.
Yeah.
So thanks.
That's right. We're all going to die. Nothing's timeless. You see, bring it full circle.
That's right. Absolutely. Right. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you out there, everyone who listened. I hope you really enjoyed this episode. I hope you really enjoyed the movie. A Ghost Waits is fantastic. It's beautiful. I really, really think it's worth everyone's time. Check out the Blu-ray. Or just, head over to Aeroplayer and, check it out there. However you want to see it, but I think it's worth your time. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to tune in next week. Drop me a rating or review. and we'll see you next time.